Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
There's a new COVID variant going around. The main symptom sounds nasty. Thankfully, global immunity has come a long way.
The vaccines have been massively important to build the communal immunity in as safe a way as possible.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, forests and wetlands can be used as a natural defense system during times of war.
It would be maybe more clever and also cheaper to use nature, at least at sites when we have forests and wetlands.
Plus, an athletic competition where performance-enhancing drugs are not just allowed, they are encouraged. But transparency only goes so far.
We will never share what an athlete is taking because it's a medical situation, so we respect the privacy of athletes.
Doping for gold and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Friday. We start our show with the latest from Israel and Iran. Today, the seventh straight day of Israel's bombing campaign, people in the Iranian capital, Tehran, took to the streets to deliver a message of defiance. They waved Iranian flags and stomped on Israeli ones, chanting, "Death to Israel, death to America." Many residents of the sprawling city of 10 million are fleeing to other, presumably safer parts of the country. As one Tehran resident told The Guardian newspaper, "I'm constantly afraid that a missile might hit my home, my city, or the homes of my relatives and friends." Also today, Iran's foreign minister met with European diplomats in Geneva, but he told an Iranian broadcaster, "We don't want to negotiate with anyone until this aggression stops." Later, the Islamic Republic news agency called the talks in Switzerland respectful and serious. This was shortly after Iran fired another barrage of missiles at Israel earlier today. One of them landed in the center of the northern Israeli city of Haifa, causing damage, including at the city's two oldest mosques, and sending a huge plume of smoke into the air. Commercial flights have stopped going in or out of Israel and Iran, and now people like Carrie Beslari are seeking refuge in Cyprus, in the resort town of Larnaca. Beslari had been visiting Israel to connect with her Jewish roots. Along with hundreds of others, she got out of the country on a Cyprus-bound cruise ship.
Explosions, we saw missiles, we heard sirens, we were out in public, we went to shelter the minute we got that notification. It's a very scary time.
That's from a video posted online by the Jerusalem Press Club. People evacuating Israel are not the only ones landing in Cyprus right now.
New flights have started to arrive from Hungary, from Rome, from Georgia.
Arieh Ze'ev Raskin is the chief rabbi of Cyprus. He says the island has become a transit point for Israelis abroad trying to get back home.
All people who are on the way ended up here with the hope that since Larnaca and Paphos are the closest nearby neighbor of Israel, once the flights will begin, that will be the first shuttle to go.
An estimated 6,500 people are waiting for flights in Cyprus. The rabbi says that Larnaca's Jewish community center is now a hub for people seeking shelter and meals. Yossi Levitan is there cooking for his fellow stranded travelers. "I really want to return," he says, "but the sky is closed." Meanwhile, Iranians are in a near-total communication blackout. According to NetBlocks.org, a group that advocates for internet access, Iran has been disconnected from the global internet for at least 36 hours. The Associated Press has called the lack of information going into or out of Iran stunning. Our reporters have been doing in-depth coverage of the war between Israel and Iran throughout this week. Head to theworld.org for more. We'll continue to follow it. Nature has always played an important role in the history of warfare. Mountains and rivers form barriers. Tanks get bogged down in muddy wetlands. Winter itself can be a more formidable foe than the actual enemy. In the early days of the war in Ukraine, the Ukrainians blew up a dam on the Irpin River. The flooding that followed helped prevent Russian troops from advancing toward Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. European scientists took a closer look at this event. They're using it as evidence that governments should restore natural ecosystems as a means of national defense. We'll hear from one of those scientists in a moment, but first, we want to take you to the Irpin River in Ukraine. A year after it was flooded, the world's Carolyn Beeler paid a visit to look at the lingering impact.
Tetiana Samolenko used to have a root cellar at her home in the village of Damidiv. Now her potatoes have a swimming pool. We're perched on the top two steps of the cellar. Scummy water with shriveled, blackened potatoes floating in it covers everything else. It's about 3 feet deep, she tells me. It's been here since shortly after Ukrainian forces blew a hole in a nearby dam on the Irpin River last February. Water reached the floor of her house. Some of her neighbors had it worse, but it's an inconvenience even for Samolenko. Her well was contaminated and she can't drink the water anymore. It's too dirty, she says. All of the sewage system got flooded too, and all the toilets. Everything was floating here. While we're talking, her dogs start barking. Her brother-in-law drops off several 5-liter bottles of water at the gate. This is how she's gotten drinking water for over a year now. But despite all of this, Samolenko is still glad that the dam burst. I'm not mad, she says. Had this not happened, Russians would have reached Kyiv. That is largely the public sentiment here, where some people have started calling the Irpin a hero river. The dam hasn't been repaired yet. Standing on top of it, you can see the 7,000 acres that remain flooded. It looks like a lake, just with the tops of trees sticking out. On a warm June afternoon, people sit and relax or bike along the dam. Two swans float by on the water.
What are you catching here?
Ryba okunь.
Volodymyr Nikiporenko is fishing in the shallow water. Through an interpreter, he says if it were up to him, he would have burst the dam behind us too.
Правильно, конечно. Если бы, я кажу, не подорвали, вони проїхали і були б у Києві.
It was a right decision, because if they hadn't blown it, the Russians will be in Kyiv.
Now that this is flooded, it looks like you're having a nice afternoon fishing. Do you want it to stay this way?
Хотів би, щоб залишалось.
Yeah, I want it to stay this way.
Roman Lysenko says conservationists in Ukraine largely say the same thing.
It's quite like what it used to look like in the spring, maybe 100 years ago.
Lysenko is a biologist with the Ukrainian Nature Conservation Group. He says the dam was built in the 1960s, and that dried out this natural floodplain. Now the Irpin River is running closer to its natural course again, and the water has receded from the homes it originally flooded.
Now almost everything that remains under the water is natural floodplains.
Lysenko is watching the water as he's speaking with me, spotting individual species to gauge the health of this new ecosystem. He interrupts himself when what looks like a gray smudge flies low over the water.
I don't know English for it.
Gray heron?
Gray heron, yes.
Is that a good sign to you?
Of course, yes, it's a good sign. I think we will see that biodiversity will bloom here.
This place is a safe nursery for small fish and good for plants that need fluctuating amounts of water, like wild orchids, he says.
But for birds, it's like heaven.
For birds, it's heaven.
Yes. You saw gray heron, you saw swans, and if we stay here for longer, we could see a lot more.
This is not how conservationists would have restored this ecosystem had they planned it. Fertilizer and sewage were likely swept into the water when the dam behind us was damaged, and of course homes were flooded. But now it's closer to natural than it has been in decades, Lysenko says.
Maybe it's optimal. It's optimal for the nature, and it's still optimal for the defense of our country.
The Ukrainian military has told residents this new wetland will stay here until at least the end of the war. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Demidiev, Ukraine.
As we learned from Carolyn's reporting, Ukraine did not intend to restore the wetlands around the Irpin River. Blowing up the dam was a military calculation. Scientists in neighboring Poland took note, and they've come up with a proposal to fortify Polish borders by using the existing landscape. Michał Smachorski is one of those scientists. He's with the Mammal Research Institute of the Polish Academy of Sciences. When I spoke with him, he explained that he's already presented these ideas to Poland's military leadership.
Instead of building bunkers, trenches, concrete obstacles, and so on, it would be maybe more clever and also cheaper to use nature, at least at sites when we have forests and wetlands.
Elaborate more on that. You presented these ideas to the military leadership in Poland. What was the reaction and what did you specifically recommend?
Yeah, we prepared a list of very specific measures that can be taken, in our opinion, to reduce penetrability of the area. So we suggested, for example, to reduce road density, to narrow some of these roads in the forest, to change forest management, to allow forests to develop in a natural way, to allow deadwood to be left in the forest. We don't need to remove this deadwood from the forest. So such a forest, it's much more difficult to go through. So we listed all these suggestions and we contacted with the Ministry of Defense. And surprisingly, at least to me, it was surprising that they were very positive about this idea. The ministry said that from their perspective, it's also very useful instructions or suggestions, and they are also aware about the different level of penetrability of different landscapes or different habitats. So they seem to be interested in using these ideas and in changing the management of landscape management in the borderland.
What would the scale of this look like actually in Poland?
Yeah, because we have pretty long border with Russia in the north and Belarus in the east. We are now talking about hundreds of kilometers of the border with these two countries. So it should be rather a large scale initiative.
Are there enough wetlands and forests to make a difference, either in terms of military or climate benefits?
Yeah, there are existing wetlands or forests, but also there are pretty many old wetlands that have been drained during recent tens of years, but can be still restored. But we need to change the water management. This should be a huge change, because up until now, we are thinking mainly about the water as a problem. But we need to change the way how we think, how we perceive water in the landscape, and these areas very close to the border, we should increase the water amount of water, and we should re-wet these old drained bogs and wetlands.
Hmm. What is the thinking, Michał, around pursuing these solutions as security considerations instead of explicit climate policies?
Of course, the decreasing wetness of habitats is a known problem for biologists, for researchers, for conservationists for decades, but it's not enough for the government to start doing something, because the environment is maybe not there, and biodiversity, it's not justification good enough to spend money and to do something in the reality in the field. So by joining these aims, by saying that okay, we can have so many benefits at the same time, like the security, environment, biodiversity, climate, I think we are increasing the chance of doing this at the end. So I hope that linking those aims and linking, showing the positive association between those benefits can show that these environmental issues are so important and can be so beneficial for the whole country.
Michał Smachorski is the director of the Mammal Research Institute of the Polish Academy of Sciences. He spoke with us from eastern Poland, not far from the border with Belarus. Later in the show, the razor blade sore throat that some say comes with the new COVID variant. It sounds nasty, but how much do we have to worry about it? You're with the world.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, The World has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For nearly every sport, the Olympics are seen as the pinnacle of success for any athlete. Clean athletes, that is. Competitors go through rigorous anti-doping testing. That's what a new competition wants to change. The Enhanced Games, as they're called, want to, quote, reinvent sports with science by encouraging athletes to use performance-enhancing drugs. Yes, it is controversial. From the World Sports Desk, here's Bianca Hillier.
Take your mark. Is underway. It's showtime for James Magnussen.
2011 was a breakout year for Australian swimmer James Magnussen. He won his first world championship and spent the next 8 years dedicated to the sport, earning the nickname The Missile before retiring in 2019. Then, just last year, he heard about the Enhanced Games and went on the Hello Sport podcast with an offer.
If they put up $1 million for the 50 freestyle world record, I'll come on board as their first athlete. I'll juice to the gills and I'll break it within 6 months.
Oh! Juice to the gills. Translation, take drugs, go fast. The Enhanced Games, founded by Australian entrepreneur Aaron D'Souza, welcomed Magnussen to the team. 8 months later, he started his performance-enhancing drug regimen. A documentary released by The Enhanced Games shows parts of the journey.
Nothing I'm doing is illegal. I have prescriptions for everything that I have and will take throughout this process.
Dan Turner, director of athlete safety and performance at the Enhanced Games, says that's true. All of the substances are approved for human use by regulators like the FDA. Critics of the Enhanced Games point out that when a regulator like the FDA approves a substance, it's approved for specific purposes. For example, testosterone products are FDA approved for men with low testosterone levels in conjunction with an associated medical condition. Testosterone is not approved to enhance an athlete's ability to perform, though it is used illicitly for that purpose. Turner says his team knows what athletes are putting in their bodies, but they're not sharing those details with the public. Critics say if it's safe, then why not?
We will never share what an athlete is taking because it's a medical situation, so we respect the privacy of athletes.
Athletes who want to take performance-enhancing drugs can work with their personal doctors to create a dosing plan, or they can work with the independent medical and scientific commissions at the Enhanced Games as part of what the company calls a clinical research trial.
Within that research trial, there are then a number of substances that are medically approved for human use, And this will be done all within the confines of an ethically approved clinical research trial.
But, Turner adds, that trial is still awaiting approval.
And so it's best not get ahead of where we're at right now.
The Enhanced Games declined to share if the athletes who have already started taking performance-enhancing drugs, like James Magnussen, are part of the trial. That's problematic, according to some scientists, like Ian Bordley, who researches performance-enhancing drugs at the University of Birmingham in the UK.
This can't be a trial, as they claim, because they're already started. And they haven't got the ethical approval beforehand. So they might publish some results on their website, but no scientist would put any value in those results.
Bordley's research colleague, Martin Chandler, adds that there isn't enough research to know how these drugs impact people long term, from heart to cognitive functions.
There's growing evidence around issues with memory, issues with problem solving, with reasoning. We don't know how serious those are, how long they last, whether or not they're reversible. But with physical changes to brain structure, the chances are those are probably permanent changes. But again, we can't tell you whether it's down to duration of use or the amount that they used or a combination of those things.
The team at the Enhanced Games is adamant that they regularly monitor athletes for possible health issues. Dan Turner, director of athlete safety, says there have not been any serious adverse effects in the athletes so far.
I imagine if we continue this same level of surveillance and supervision that we have currently, I don't see why we can't continue with having that same level of interaction with all athletes that compete in the games.
As far as making athletes faster, the results have been mixed. The Enhanced Games documentary shows that 6 weeks into taking the drugs, swimmer James Magnussen ballooned to 252 pounds with muscle mass he'd never seen before.
My lifts in the gym skyrocketed. My power in the pool skyrocketed. But with that 252 pounds, my flotation in the pool it descended quite drastically.
Magnussen got stronger, but not faster. Then came Greek swimmer and four-time Olympian Christian Golomev. Last month, the Enhanced Games released videos of Golomev swimming the fastest ever recorded 50-meter freestyle. He got $1 million in prize money, but it doesn't count as the real world record since he did it while taking performance-enhancing drugs. Golomev also likely won't be allowed to compete in a professional swim meet ever again. World Aquatics, the sport's global governing body, announced a new rule this month that anyone who supports or participates in events promoting banned substances is ineligible for competition. The World Anti-Doping Agency and the International Olympic Committee have also strongly condemned the Enhanced Games for its approach to health and ethics. Keep in mind, the Enhanced Games haven't even started yet.
Las Vegas, let's make some noise! Let's make some noise, Las Vegas!
The first event will take place in May of 2026 in the City of Sin, Las Vegas. The company is aiming to sign between 60 and 100 athletes in swimming, track, and weightlifting events. So far, only four swimmers, all men, have signed on. One athlete who James Magnussen would like to see join the Enhanced Games is his former rival in the pool, Nathan Adrian. Perhaps their most memorable face-off was at the London Olympics in 2012.
James Magnussen in lane four. Below him is Adrian, trying to get to the wall first. Too close to call right now as they come to the wall. Adrian with a goal for the U.S. by 1/100th of a second.
Adrian beat Magnussen by the smallest possible margin to win the gold medal. Earlier this month, Magnussen went back on the Hello Sport podcast.
We have this great rivalry. I'd love to race Nathan Adrian at the Enhanced Games and give all those fans one more opportunity to see two big names go head to head.
I call Adrian, a five-time Olympic gold medalist who hasn't competed professionally since 2021, to hear his response to the offer.
I would love to swim against James again. I loved and still love to compete, and I certainly think that James feels the same way. That's why he would join in on this. So that's part of who we are.
But Adrian adds, he's not about to sign up for the project himself. For one thing, he says the enhanced games haven't reached out. His family also just welcomed a new baby, and he was diagnosed with cancer at just 30 years old. That changed his perspective on everything.
To do this and experiment with my own body is not something I'm like super, super interested in at this time.
Adrian says he will be watching with curiosity, though, when the enhanced games get underway next spring. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're with The World. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. COVID-19 is still with us. There's a new variant accounting for about a third of cases here in the U.S. NB181 comes from the Omicron variant. Remember Omicron? And has been referred to as Nimbus. Some people who get Nimbus say one of the symptoms is pretty painful. It's been dubbed razor blade throat. Very sore throat. Despite that, the World Health Organization does not rate it as a variant of concern, at least not yet. Michael Minna is an independent epidemiologist and immunologist based in Boston.
It has been spreading, you know, into the United States now from the Mediterranean area in Europe. It is likely going to dominate, is my guess, although another variant could come around. It, similar to prior Omicron variants and other variants, you know, since the beginning of this pandemic, it has some fitness advantages, meaning it can spread in the background of the immunological sort of memory pool that humans now have. These viruses spread by mutating a bit and evading the pre-existing immunity, which is normal for viruses in general. And so this one seems to have done a decent job at developing some mutations that allow it to get around our protective immunity, at least in our upper respiratory tract. And my expectation is that this is going to be the summer wave, as we've seen each year during the pandemic. And this virus will probably be a dominant virus as we move into July and August.
Yeah. What are you watching for this summer when it comes to NB181?
Well, what we've seen in the past is really what I'm looking for. Again, I'm expecting that we'll be seeing very similar dynamics where we'll have a rise in cases in the United States, as an example, that's really driven from cases happening in the South and Southeast, the much warmer areas where we see a major influx of people indoors with air conditioning on. And that kind of seeds outbreaks that then can spread throughout the country, and this in turn seeds outbreaks in the Northeast and the Northwest and throughout the United States. So we see these kind of waves. And a lot of it is because of the differences in sort of people's exposure to humidity or air conditioning, for example.
Yeah, I've seen reports that suggest Asia has already been dealing with Nimbus. So in places that have started to see a Nimbus wave, I guess you have not seen very bad rates of hospitalization. But what about certain age groups? Are they dealing with it better or worse?
So that's exactly right. We aren't seeing increased rates relative to other variants, you know, in the past year, for example. And that's generally because as humans, we now have pretty darn robust immunity against SARS-CoV-2 viruses. And there's an important piece here where our immune systems can actually recognize a lot of different parts of the virus. And by having that breadth of recognition, even if the virus changes parts of its spike protein to evade the neutralizing antibodies that are needed to stop transmission, we still have a lot of immunity and a lot of education from exposures and vaccines and all sorts of things that allow us to still remain quite protected against serious illness. Now, the folks who are not going to be as protected are the same folks that have always not been as protected. These are the elderly individuals, the vulnerable individuals who might be immune suppressed. These people will still be at greater risk for severe disease. And that's why, especially when it comes to vaccinating, we should still be really focusing, especially on ensuring that older individuals and higher risk individuals still get vaccinated, even in the context of widespread immunity, where we might be seeing other groups, especially globally, putting less emphasis on annual boosting.
What role have vaccinations played in building up that communal immunity?
Massive. The vaccines have been massively important to build the communal immunity in as safe a way as possible. In the absence of vaccines, we would have had a much rockier road, many more severe infections and deaths along the way. And so vaccines have given us this amazing cushion, this ability to build up a community level of immunity where we're no longer seeing as many hospitalizations and deaths, and we're no longer seeing as much long COVID. And we've been able to build it in a much more safer way as a result of the vaccines. They have been easily the most important singular tool at our disposal during this pandemic.
Razorblade throat sounds like something out of a horror movie. Michael, how painful is it compared to your typical sore throat?
From what I hear, while it's been given this name of razorblade sore throat, my expectation is that when we cut through all the noise, it's probably going to be a virus that is aggressively attaching to the throat and causing some pain. But is that actually due to the virus or to a strong immunological response against the virus, which is actually where a lot of symptoms often come from, is difficult to say.
In March, Michael, we mark 5 years since the start of the COVID pandemic. You've given us today a good primer on this new variant, almost part of a predictable summer wave. Generally, though, how would you describe where we are at in the life of this pandemic?
Yeah, to be honest, I think we are at more or less where I was expecting we would be at by late 2020. I called this virus a textbook a respiratory virus, which unfortunately a lot of people assume that I meant that it was not a deadly virus. That's not at all what I meant. What I meant was that the virus was invading humans who were massively susceptible because there was no immunity in the childhood or adult population. And so what that meant is we had to have multiple years of gaining immunity to the virus before we start to sort of get onto an off-ramp, which I would say we're well on. If not, we might even be off the off-ramp at this point from the pandemic. And now it's been 5 years. Most humans have seen the virus multiple times. Most humans, or many, many humans, have been vaccinated multiple times. And so we have built up this big bedrock of immunity across the population. And so the pandemic is sort of in this transition phase still, where I think it's becoming a seasonal virus. But that all said, I think we are in this transition phase that I view as a natural evolution of the pandemic into an endemic.
Michael Minna is an independent epidemiologist and public health advisor based in Boston. 4 years ago in Spain, a news photo became an instant symbol of both despair and empathy. It showed two people on a beach, an exhausted man weeping, being held in the arms of a woman, a Red Cross volunteer. Abdul Nom was the man in the picture, one of many African migrants at the time, trying to reach Europe to start a new life. That image of him with a volunteer is back in the news because Abdul Nom died unexpectedly. He was 37. The World's Jerry Haddon brings us his story.
On a May afternoon in 2021, more than 6,000 mostly African migrants swam from northern Morocco into the neighboring Spanish enclave of Ceuta. On the Ceuta beach, it was chaos. Spanish border agents and paramedics rushed among the exhausted migrants. Some lay lifeless on the sand. Among the dead was Abdul Nom's little brother. When Nom found out, he collapsed in grief into the arms of the Red Cross volunteer who was giving him water. In a video from that day, 20-year-old Luna Reyes strokes Nom's hair as he pulls her closer, his face gaunt, grimacing in anguish. Photos of the moment went viral. Spanish TV interviewed Reyes just afterwards. His eyes were really red, she said, distraught. He looked at me as if he'd never seen another human being. He was in a state of total despair, she said. That hug for him was like his life preserver, she said. But it was not enough to save him. Nom, along with most of the new arrivals, was deported within hours back to Morocco in violation of Spain's asylum laws. Nom made his way to Morocco's Atlantic coast, where he met his future wife. They had a baby girl. Last year, he boarded a wooden fishing boat bound for Spain's Canary Islands. Spain's Coast Guard rescued them after 3 days at sea. This time he was allowed to stay in Spain, so he made his way to a friend's in Malaga in the south. There he worked in construction, sending money back to his wife and daughter.
Chico muy listo, muy bueno, trabajadores.
Noam was bright and kind and a hard worker, a friend told a Malaga TV station this week.
Abdul, el chico del abrazo, murió el martes. La autopsia va a determinar de qué.
Noam was back in the news because days earlier, his struggle for a better life had come to an end. Noam's roommates had found him lifeless on his bed. He'd been vomiting for days and complaining of fever, but he stayed away from doctors, they say, because he didn't have papers or the money. Neither the Red Cross nor Spain's Commission for Refugee Aid responded by airtime for comment on Abdou Noam's case. In all, 8 years have passed since he first left Senegal. He'd been orphaned as a child and now leaves his own child behind. As for Reyes, the young Red Cross volunteer, when the photo with Noam went viral, her social media accounts were bombarded with messages of anti-immigrant hate and bigotry. How could she hug that guy, people asked her. How couldn't she said. Then she closed down her accounts. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
A major New York City museum is opening a Tibetan Buddhist shrine room. The immersive installation invites the audience to admire Buddhist art and reflect. But as Gisele Regatao reports from Brooklyn, the new exhibit is also raising important questions about the ownership of sacred objects.
Recordings of monks chanting fill an enclosed room at the Brooklyn Museum. The shrine has 124 objects: paintings, sculptures, silk decorations, musical instruments, flickering lamps, and offerings. But since we're in a museum, it's not real food. It's fake rice. The objects are from the 12th to the 21st centuries. Elena Pakutova curated the shrine. She says the objects are not meant to be understood as just historical pieces.
Our intention is to show that this is a living tradition, and this is an example of a very elaborate and wealthy household shrine, in which a family may have collected this through generations.
Pakutova is a senior curator of Himalayan art at the Rubin Museum. That's where the shrine used to live. It was one of Rubin's most popular works. More than 1 million people visited there from 2013 to 2024. But the Rubin closed its building last year. It will now work with other organizations to continue to show its collection.
We're actually reaching more people in many more other places that may have not had the opportunity to see Himalayan art otherwise.
But not everybody is happy with the installation here. The anonymous collective Our Ancestors Say No is demanding the return of the shrine to the Tibetan community. They claim they are stolen artifacts. Pakutova says that's a complicated issue.
Return to Tibet, to Chinese government. And of course, Rubin Museum takes very seriously any claims of misappropriation of sculptures.
Tibet was incorporated into China in 1950. The Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhists, and he lives in exile in the Indian Himalayas. The majority of Tibetans are Buddhists, and shrines are part of many households and public spaces.
Both inside Tibet and also in the Tibetan diaspora, they are a part of life.
Wen-Xing Zhou is an associate professor of art history at Hunter College and an expert on Tibetan Buddhism. She also serves on the advisory board of the Rubin Museum, an unpaid position. Zhou says the Tibetan Buddhist shrine room presents Buddhist art in a different way.
You're not seeing them as singular pieces of gods, deities, or teachers. It's the assembly that creates the kind of power of the space.
The shrine room also includes 8 stools where the audience can sit to observe, meditate, or pray. Some argue that religious artifacts are sacred and shouldn't be in an art institution.
I respect the opinion of people who are unhappy with these objects being in museums.
Joan Cummings is the senior curator of Asian art at the Brooklyn Museum.
But I also think that there are multiple opinions out there, and that there is really some value to sharing this with our visitors.
Cummings says the shrine is very different from other Asian art presented at the Brooklyn Museum. She says it will allow people to learn about the many ideas that shape Tibetan Buddhism.
The complexity of the imagery in the shrine is a testament to the complexity of the tradition. It's super scholarly. Teachings get added on top of teachings, and it's just a really rich, rich heritage.
The shrine will be at the Brooklyn Museum for 6 years. Cummings says that will allow it to become a destination.
It will, we hope, be something that people remember fondly about their trip here.
Nia Tripathi is a college student who is visiting the shrine. Her family is from Nepal, and she says she could recognize some of the artwork.
I've seen them like everywhere. Like, they look very familiar to me.
Tripathi says she appreciates seeing traditions from her ancestors at a major art institution.
When you put something in a museum, you kind of put it on a pedestal. So like for me, seeing something that like, there's something very similar in my grandma's house. Like there's a mini version of this like in my own house.
The shrine is opening as the Brooklyn Museum struggles financially. Whether people find a connection in the exhibit or learn something new, the hope is that it will help bring more visitors through its doors. For The World, I'm Gisele Rigatow, Brooklyn, New York City.
Gisele's story is part of our reporting on sacred spaces around the globe. Find more at our website, where we visit a fertility temple in Bhutan, a soccer stadium for football fanatics in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and a Sufi shrine where women convene in Tunisia. It's a collection of stories about places people go to connect with something greater than themselves. Check it out at theworld.org/sacrednation. This Sunday in the UK is Windrush Day, celebrating the contributions of post-World War II migrants who came to Britain from the Caribbean. They arrived on the vessel HMT Windrush, and their descendants are recognized across the United Kingdom. Yesterday on the show, we paid tribute to one of them who'd recently died, Sir Geoffrey Palmer, a major figure in the science of brewing beer and whiskey. Someone, as we heard, who had to overcome years of racism in Scotland.
It wasn't easy. Politicians who said, if you want to N-word a person for a neighbor, vote Labour.
With Windrush Day coming up this Sunday, we wanted to hear another voice from that generation of immigrants.
If I was a top-notch poet like Chris Okigbo, Derek Walcott, R.T.S. Eliot, I would write a poem so damn deep that it bittersweet.
That's 73-year-old Linton Kwesi Johnson reading the first lines to his poem, If I Was a Top-Notch Poet. LKJ, as he's known, was born in Clarendon, Jamaica, and in 1963 joined his mother in England, who'd already arrived as part of the Windrush group. For Johnson, writing poetry in the language of Jamaican dub music lyrics was his way of expressing anger against the racism he experienced growing up in the UK, at school and at university. LKJ is one of the rare living poets and the only black poet to be published in the Penguin Modern Classic series. Over the years, Linton Kwesi Johnson's literary themes have grown more diverse, and he's given his poetry a musical dimension by collaborating with the Dennis Bovell Dub Band in London. This number, The Eagle and the Bear, goes back to 1985 and the last gasps of the Cold War. As you can hear, LKJ's words are still relevant today.
The eagle and the bear are people living in fear of impending nuclear warfare. But as a matter of fact, believe it or not, plenty people don't care whether it's imminent or not. First going to attack or if the human...
After a long trip, the first thing you tell people when you get home might not be about the bed you slept in or the communal breakfast in the hotel lobby. But hospitality does make a big difference in how you experience a place, whether it's a spare bed in a stranger's house or just someone taking the time to show you around. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek knows this. He's been tracing the path of human migration on his Out of Eden walk on the road for 12 years, a trip spanning multiple continents and experiencing multiple ways of being welcomed. Paul, welcome back. Let's start with the hospitality that greeted you recently at a traditional guest house in Japan. Tell us more about that place and the woman who runs it.
Marco, we were walking, me and my Japanese walking partner, a fellow journalist, into an industrial city called Shunan on the main island. And it was getting late in the day. And as sometimes the case in Japan, we couldn't find any lodging. We couldn't find any rooms. In desperation, my friend Soichiro began just calling businesses to say, do you know any place in your neighborhood? And that's how we turfed up the Migita Guest House, which is kind of invisible online and run by an 84-year-old woman named Yoshiko.
Wow. So industrial neighborhood, describe this guest house. What does it look like?
It looked like any other building, except once you got inside through a doorway made out of paper, you knew that you were entering a more traditional setting, something that was quite old, even a time portal, if you will, into a maze of corridors that were darkened and clearly built a long time ago because it was quite small. I had to stoop over to kind of find my room.
Yeah, and so Yoshiko, what was she like? I mean, what's kind of the origin story of her and this guest house?
Well, you know, as a fellow storyteller, Marco, you bump into people who your storyteller's radar kind of blinks on, and you say, okay, here's a person that you might pass on the sidewalk, not even notice, right? She's quite petite. She's got an elfin kind of a aura about her, smiling, friendly, super polite. But she's had a very hard life. She grew up in a small village near this city during World War II. She remembered the B-29 bombers flying overhead en route to Tokyo. Her father disappeared into a POW camp in Manchuria and didn't come back from the war until 4 years later.
Wow.
A ghost of his former self. And she had a very... I imagine, you know, the thing about this generation of Japanese is that they're often quite reserved about sharing... you know, personal details. But what I could gather from bits and pieces is that she was basically forced into a forced marriage, which didn't work. And she left after 6 months, scandalizing her village, and had to leave. So she came to the city and somehow opened up this ryokan, the Migita Ryokan in Shunan.
I know Japan is not unique in this hospitality. I mean, you've often stayed with strangers who welcomed you into their homes. Did you feel like a guest in Yoshika's home more than a customer at an inn? I mean, it seems like this isn't just transactional for her.
This is true. I think this is partly what keeps her in the business for so long, right? For decades. She opened the Migita Guest House in 1965. So it's been going on, you know, for all this time, about 60 plus years. I think once you step into a space that a person has been managing that long, even if it's a commercial space, you are stepping into their home. It's like being in the house of your grandmother, and she's very, very warm and very, very friendly, and like a lot of people who've had very difficult lives, extremely compassionate, right? And also minimizing her own suffering a lot. I would question her about her girlhood, her early life. And she would just laugh and throw back her head and guffaw and clap whenever it got to a tough spot. Yeah.
Your story about Yoshiko made me really curious about the hospitality you've encountered elsewhere on your Out of Eden walk. How did this version of hospitality compare with what you've experienced elsewhere?
It was of a kind. It was of a kind. So my project depends a lot on kind of chance and serendipity. So I can't really plan ahead. I rely on in the moment acts of compassion, right? And I wouldn't be talking to you today if this didn't happen over and over like a daily miracle. I've been admitted to shepherd's huts. I've been admitted to big palaces. I've been admitted to even caves, inhabited caves. So I think this for me is an affirmation. It's kind of the energy that keeps me going, is finding people who share not only their stories, but also a cup of tea and maybe a place to rest your head.
Does any particular place stand out in your mind for that sense of warmth and welcome we all kind of anticipate when we think hospitality?
You know, I've been asked this before, and I've got to say it's you know, there's a lot of bad news in the world, Marco, as you know. But I'm happy to report that the vast majority, the staggering majority of the human population, I would say above 90% across cultures and borders and languages and ideologies, is hospitable. That said, there is a distinction, maybe a little bit economically, that is not surprising, a bit of a banal observation, that kind of the people who have the least are often the most hospitable, right? Because they know suffering and they can recognize it in others.
I'm just curious if you had any surprises or maybe cultural missteps anywhere on your travels relating to unfamiliar hospitality traditions.
I'm sure all the time, and I'm sure many of my hosts were probably too polite to point out how many thousands of faux pas I was making, you know, in
Japan.
Which
is hospitality, too.
It is hot. That's compassion for the clumsy, you know, dumbbell who's kind of staggering through your doorway with a backpack on and sweaty and smelly and with dirty clothes, right? So, something about Japan that stands out is that I think the traditions of human interactions and hospitality in the case of this conversation are even more extremely codified, more highly refined and developed. Mm. So, for example, coming into somebody's house You take your shoes off, of course, and of course, everybody knows that. I took my shoes off. But sometimes in some homes, you put your shoes in a certain place, you know, to the left and not to the right. So I've had, you know, hosts or hostesses kind of very quietly, when they think I'm not looking, take my shoes and move them. So there's even kind of a microgeography to hospitality.
Paul, I'm guessing after being on the road so long, you think differently today about hospitality than maybe you used to.
Yeah, you know, I do. It's been a lifelong thing, Marco. I left the United States when I was 5 and a half and moved to another culture, and so kind of growing up within different cultures as a minority of one, you become sensitive to this. And what I say often, it's kind of the mantra of my project, is I'm not walking to a place. You know, geographically, I'm walking to the tip of South America on the Out of Eden Walk, but what I'm walking to every single day is other people. People are my destination, because I know from a lifelong experience, even Marco, similar with you as a war correspondent, that there's goodness there, and you just have to look for it.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek, it is always a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco. Always fun to talk.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can now find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. We're at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the summer solstice and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.